tonight we're going to move beyond the Sermon on the Plain into chapter 7 of the Gospel according to Luke. And the big question here is, the major question that Luke addresses in the next few chapters is, just who is this Jesus? Who is this Jesus that is giving these teachings? Who is this Jesus that is standing up to the religious leaders? Who is this Jesus that the stories say he has healed people, etc.? And for Luke, the statement about who Jesus is for the individual depends on the faith that they show. Who is Jesus? Well, it depends on the faith that you show. The faith that you show, the faith that you profess, the faith that you have makes a statement about who Jesus is for you, which may influence others as well. So for Luke, the major question to be answered here is, who is Jesus? And we find here that Israel is not the only group that is confronted with this question. The Gentiles are confronted with it as well, not just the Romans, but other Gentiles, the Greek. Though Luke does not mention in the next couple of chapters specifically the Decapolis, a lot of what takes place in the next couple of chapters is around the area known as the Decapolis, which was to the north and the east, north, northeast, and east of Galilee. Decapolis comes from two Greek words, deca, which means ten, and polis, which means city-state. And they were ten cities that were, while there were some Jews there, the majority of folks were Gentiles, were Greeks that were in that area, along with some Romans, etc. At one point in time, the Romans would, well, not just at one point in time, but a lot of times, the Romans followed what Alexander the Great did when he conquered the known world. They would extradite people there, their own citizenry or slaves, and force them to marry with the people of the land that they've just conquered, thereby hopefully to keep down any disturbances, any protests, any revolts, because then you're revolting against people that you kin to. That's not always the best thing to do, because a lot of times the worst fights are between kin. But here, Israel's not the only group. The Roman centurion shows that the Gentiles are included in Jesus' mission. Yes, Jesus comes to the Jews first, but not just the Jews. And he doesn't go after just the Jews only early. He starts dealing with Gentiles early in his public ministry as well. And we will find later on that the centurion's faith is actually contrasted with that of Israel. And Jesus has more positive things to say, a more positive statement about the centurion and his faith. And he's not even a Jew and doesn't really know God like the Hebrew should, with that of Israel, who is supposed to know and should recognize more of Jesus, but has turned the other way. Has turned the other way. And so here in Luke chapter 7, we find that story of the centurion's servant, a story that is also found in the Gospel of Mark, a story that in which we find this Roman centurion. After Jesus had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. So he's moving, he's in Galilee, he's outside of Capernaum. After the sayings in front of all the people, that is, Sermon on the Plain, then Jesus and his disciples head into Capernaum, that seacoast town along the Sea of Galilee, and then eventually he will move through there and over into the area around the Decapolis. A centurion there had a slave whom he valued highly and who was ill and close to death. This centurion is has his servant, has his slave, but he's become fond of that servant, fond of that slave. It's still a slave, still does whatever task the centurion would have him do, but the centurion probably, and the word used here, or the wording here indicates the centurion probably thought the slave almost like family. This would have been a slave that would have been with him for a long time for him to build up that rapport with that slave. The Roman authority in Capernaum is vested in that centurion, which is a contrast with God's great power in Jesus and through Jesus. So we've got this Roman authority, this centurion, means he's over 100 men, 100 of Caesar's troops, who has authority, he knows he has authority, and yet he defers his authority to that of God in Jesus. So you've got the contrast of the earthly authority of the Romans. They thought that they had it all. But the centurion has come to realize the things he can't do. He's heard these stories about Jesus. He's kept up with what's been going on, maybe not always by people who are positive in their look or their view of Jesus, but some of the other Israelites around. And so he is deferring and hoping that perhaps whatever God Jesus represents, because this Roman centurion would have worshipped a wide range of gods, will have some kind of power and authority to heal his servant. The centurion's slave is near death and cannot be transported. That's an important statement here in Luke. It's not like the men who brought the paralytic on a pallet and lowered him down. This centurion's near the point of death and they can't bring him to Jesus because if they do, he might die on the way. So Jesus must go to him, which shows us, and for Luke, remember Luke's really interested in showing Jesus extreme interest in the poor and the outcasts. It shows us that, once again, Jesus' ministry is one where he is willing to search out even the humblest and the lowliest. Fire trucks. The humblest and the lowliest. A slave in a Roman household. That's pretty low. Pretty lowly, pretty humble. But Jesus is willing to do that. And it's interesting, though, that the centurion himself doesn't come to Jesus. The centurion has helped the elders of the synagogue in Capernaum. He is probably what in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius is called a God-fearer. Now, that didn't mean that he worshipped, he'd given up the Roman pantheon of gods and worshipped God, the Hebrew God, but he was impressed by the Jews' worship and loyalty to Yahweh. He was impressed by things that he had seen and heard. And so the God-fearer meant of Cornelius and probably this centurion that impression from the Jews about their God had gotten him to where he would help out. I mean, it's kind of like the guy who says, well, you know, I'm not sure if I'm not sure if God really exists or not, but I got all these different symbols, the Egyptian Ankh, a crucifix, a Star of David, etc., around my neck in Vietnam because I'm not sure that there's a God, but if there is one, I want to be covered. So it's kind of like this centurion will be covering all bases. Yeah. Well, if that God does have some power and authority, I'll help you guys out so that maybe if I get in trouble, he'll smile upon me, but I still sacrifice to Zeus and Apollo and, well, for the Roman, it'd be Jupiter, not Zeus, etc. So, this centurion has helped them, as I said, similar to that centurion Cornelius. And so, these leaders, also wanting to keep in good graces with the Roman centurion, go on his behalf. They go on his behalf here to Jesus, which is kind of interesting because you've got Jewish religious leaders who don't really care for Jesus and his message coming to Jesus on behalf of this Roman centurion. Talk about strange things taking place. And so the elders go and ask Jesus to come and heal the slave. And they're not sure whether Jesus can or not, but they've heard stories, and so they're getting him to come. And so these friends come when the centurion hears that Jesus is near. And they appeal to him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy of having you do this for him, for he loves our people, and it is he who built our synagogue for us." Another insight into this relationship. You know, they said, "Well, he's worthy. You need, you know, you're not like us, but he's worthy for you to come, and if you can do anything, do it because he built our local synagogue for us." And so Jesus heads that way. He went with them, but when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent more friends to him. Notice the centurion himself is not coming out to see Jesus. He is sending more friends to Jesus to say, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you. but only speak the word, and let my servant be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. The centurion said, I'm unworthy. What he's really saying is, you know, I don't want to come near you because you're a Jew, you're circumcised. I know from experience that if I come near you because I'm an uncircumcised Roman, that it will make you unclean. And I believe that you've got some kind of power, not sure what it is, but kind of like when I speak to my slaves and they do things, or my soldiers and they do things, then all you have to do is speak a word. Now that's kind of interesting, because all these Israelites, especially religious leaders, they're not liking Jesus. The only thing they're listening to his words for are for ways to trap him, to create problems for him. And here we've got this Gentile, this pagan, this Roman centurion, who believes that Jesus can do something simply by the spoken word. So here in Luke, and once again, Luke's writing to Gentiles to show that Jesus is not just for the Jews, Jesus is for the Gentiles. Here this Roman with power is going to Jesus and deferring to Jesus, who has this great power. When Jesus hears this, notice what he says. He was amazed at him, that is, the centurion, the word he sent, and turning to the crowd that followed him, tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. Jesus defines the centurion's response to him as faith, and then he gives a prophetic reproach to all the Israelites standing around, the religious leaders, his disciples, all those folks that are following him for a show. He said, this guy has more faith than I found among y'all. So on the one hand, we've got Jesus praising the centurion's humility and shaming Israel's leadership for their lack of humility and understanding. They thought they had all the answers. They thought they knew it all. They tended to be rather arrogant toward Jesus. When he hears of this faith, he shows concern for Israel, praising the centurion's work, praising his faith, and then this is, while it's a shame on the people, shame on you for not having faith, it's also a challenge. If this guy can believe, and he doesn't even know all this stuff about me from the Old Testament, why can't you believe? So Jesus is offering these folks around him an opportunity to step back, to rethink what they're doing, and to show at least the faith of a pagan. It's kind of interesting. The religious folks here, the leaders, the elders of the synagogue, do not have as much faith in God, in Jesus, as this pagan does. The pagan can see more than the elders can see. And perhaps that's because the pagan, maybe because the Roman centurion wasn't weighted down with all of these centuries of stuff that he had to wade through before he could put himself out there for Jesus. Because of that faith, we read, when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health instead of dead, and he was at the point of death when they left. Lo and behold, when they get back, the slave is well, and Jesus didn't even come in the house. We said earlier in one of the other sessions that throughout Luke, healing and the word, the spoken word, are always in close proximity in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus speaks and something happens. Shows the power of the spoken word. So, who is this Jesus? For the centurion, this Jesus may not have been God, but this Jesus was one in whom God's authority rested. For the elders, there was a question about Jesus being a charlatan. So here we've got that contrast between the lack of faith among Israel's leadership and the openness to faith from the pagan, the Roman centurion. The power of God transcends all human possibilities here and works through Jesus. This power over death here is also a foreshadowing for Luke, a foreshadowing of what will happen on what day in Jesus' life. This power over death is a foreshadowing of what day? Resurrection. Resurrection Sunday. We call it Easter Sunday. Some churches actually call it Resurrection Sunday. Next, we come to another situation with death. The servant was at the point of death, and Jesus kept him from dying simply with a spoken word from the distance. Now Jesus is faced with an even greater task and an even greater challenge. Though he's not asked to do anything, we find Jesus once again seeking out, searching out, and trying to... He takes the initiative. He takes the initiative. And God, if you look throughout the Bible, starting in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, God is the one that takes the initiative in seeking us. God is the one that always takes the initiative in seeking a relationship with us. We may think we're taking the initiative, but God's already there looking for us whenever we finally decide to turn around and look for God. So God is taking the initiative. Here Jesus, once again, takes the initiative, overcoming death. And there's an interesting contrast here. Soon afterwards, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went with him. As he approached the gate of the town, a man who had died was being carried out of the town. So here is Jesus, the author and the giver of life, coming in, and here's this dead man going out, or being carried out. So that interesting contrast. Jesus and his followers are entering with Jesus, seeking to bring life-giving words. The people in the funeral procession are leaving. As he approached the gate of the town, a man who had died was being carried out. He was his mother's only son, and she was a widow. And with her was a large crowd from the town. The woman is helpless. She's helpless. There's nothing she can do, and she is also now an outcast in society. Why? She's a widow. This is her only son. Therefore, there is no one to care for her, no one to earn a living, and no one to provide housing. This is still that part of history and among those places where women had few, if any, rights. Women could not own property generally within the Jewish world. And here we've got the powerful one, the helper, on his way in, the helpless and powerless mother of the dead man coming out. And Jesus stops. He doesn't have to stop and do anything, but Jesus seeks to help. The powerful one, the helper, helps the helpless. And Jesus simply reaches up. When the Lord saw her, had compassion and said, "Do not weep," he came forward and touched the bier, B-I-E-R, and the bearer stood still. I know some translations say a coffin, but actually he was not in a coffin. He would have been on a stretcher. You know, a bier, B-I-E-R, that you would bear something, a person's body, whether alive or dead, on, you would be carried. And he would be wrapped up in the winding sheet for them to take him outside. Put him, if they had been wealthy, would have put him in a tomb. If not, they would have taken him somewhere outside the town where there was a burial area, dug a shallow grave, put the body in it, and then stacked rocks on top of it. They'd put dirt over it and then stacked rocks on top of it. Because they didn't embalm. You don't want them hanging around if you don't embalm, right? Well, you probably don't want them hanging around if you do, but not for real long. But here, you know, it's just like within Islam. According to the Quran and according to all the laws of Islam, if at all possible, when a person dies, they're to be buried within 24 hours because you're not allowed to embalm the body. And it was a similar situation here. I mean, they really couldn't embalm. They weren't the Egyptians, and really not everybody in Egypt was embalmed. that died anyway. So they're carrying him out. Jesus stops them. He touches the coffin, as such, the bier on which he is being carried. And he simply speaks to the man. Young man, I say to you, rise. And there were probably some people that freaked out and started running. Because all of a sudden this man sat up. And he didn't just sit up, he started talking. Now we're not told what he said. Maybe they couldn't understand him because he's wrapped up and had that napkin and shroud over his face and you couldn't understand what he was saying. But he sat up and he started talking, and the mother was shocked but pleased, and some of the people probably took off and ran into the hills, and the rest of them stood around amazed. Totally amazed. But in this, the power of God becomes evident. I raise the question here, perhaps this is the precursor to the only son who is not powerless being raised from the dead. Here is an only son who is powerless. And the powerful healer raises him from the dead. Once again, very possibly a precursor to the only Son of God, who is not powerless being raised from the dead in resurrection. But here Jesus, even before his resurrection, is proving that he has the power of life and death, and he has power over all areas of life, including death. Including death. Jesus returns the son to his mother and shows his overwhelming care for the poor and the less fortunate, because you couldn't get much more less fortunate than a widow without any sons to take care of her. She wanders the streets now, eating scraps, doing whatever she can, finding any place to lie down, unless somebody takes her in. She wanders until she dies because there's no real place for her anymore. And fear seized all of them, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us." And that's what the Greek text reads, "has risen among us." And God has looked favorably on his people, and this word about him spread throughout Judea and all the surrounding country. Once again, the statement, "a prophet has risen" or "has been raised up" is a literal translation. "Prophet has been raised up" looks forward for Luke, once again, to Easter, when the only son will be raised up. He is the prophet. And this story is a sign for Luke. This story is a sign from God not to be overlooked. It's meant to point to the one whose will is not death, but whose will is life. Life now and perfect life beyond this. What it does is it points to Jesus as Son of God. It is God, the one who does not will death. God doesn't want death to be the final answer, but rather who wills life. Life now and perfect life beyond. And so once again in this, Jesus is showing his power over life and death in all spheres of existence. And immediately, you can imagine, William went walking down the street and there was somebody laying on the side of the road, and EMS said he's dead, we're going to throw him into we're going to call the coroner and all this kind of stuff. And William walked by and spoke to the man. All of a sudden he jumped up and started talking. It'd be hard to keep that word down, wouldn't it? And then we might need somebody with a defibrillator to start William's heart. Kind of like that true story that I've told y'all before, when I was working a PRN at the hospital, it was when I was working full time, and I got called up into one of the areas that nothing ever happens. One of the areas I had, the ER, neuro trauma, neuro ICU, trauma ICU. Nothing ever happens there. But I got called up for mid-20-something young black woman who had had a massive stroke, and they had finally decided after several days it's time to pull the plug. And the family wanted the chaplain up there to pray with them as they unplugged the machines, etc. And so I went up and, I'm the chaplain. Introduced myself, talked with them a little bit. I'd visited them a couple of days earlier. And the mother said, "I want you to pray," and I went, "Okay," as we disconnect. So I'm there, said, "I want everybody to hold hands." So I took her hand and the son, the girl's brother was sitting down here at the other end of the bed, and he didn't want to hold anybody's hand. So the mother said, well, just put your hand on her leg. You know, so I did, right on top of the covers, and started praying. I mean, they unplugged, and I started praying. And about halfway through that prayer, she started quivering like this in her leg, and I knew what was happening. As your body is shutting down that last little bit, that's muscle reaction, nerve reaction. I knew that in my mind. But boy, people, oh Lord, oh Jesus, hallelujah, she's going to come back. And I did. I interrupted my prayer in a way, and I said, Lord, if she does, I'm leaving here and never coming back. If that woman had sat up, I was leaving that hospital and I wasn't ever going back again. But she didn't. The nurse stepped up and said, no, ma'am, I'm sorry, but that is just not going to happen. And about 30 seconds later, the young woman expired, and we continued with our prayer and spent some time there with them and that kind of thing. So, you know, hear Jesus, but all that word starts spreading throughout the countryside as to what Jesus has done. He kept the centurion's servant from dying just with a spoken word from long distance. $1-800 prayer. And then he goes in, and this woman's son is dead, and he restores not only life to the son, but guess who else he gives life to? The mother. The mother. He provides not only life for the son, new life for the son, but new life for the mother as well, showing that concern. Well, all this stuff gets reported out, and John the Baptist is not too sure about all of this. He's not walking around with Jesus. He's not seeing it. He's getting it second, third, fourth, and 15th hand, and he really wants to know. Now remember, John and Jesus are cousins. And so, some of John's disciples, a lot of different teachers there, a lot of rabbis had disciples, those who followed them around, listened to them, etc. Some of John's disciples come and they start telling him what all happened. So, John summoned two of his disciples, two of his closest disciples would have been what happened here. He summons these two disciples and sends them to Jesus to ask him, are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another? If John hadn't seen it himself, John thought, okay, maybe he was the forerunner, but now he's wondering, well, maybe Jesus is the forerunner. Are you the one who is to come? That is the one that we've been looking for. It's not a question of God's power. It's not a question of God's purpose. It's a question of Jesus' miracles. And so he sends them to ask that question. When the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another? So the disciples and others around kind of latch onto the question. So I'm sure there are probably some people in the crowd say, yeah, right. We want to know too. You know, the crowd mentality gets up here. We want to know too. Are you that one? And notice Jesus' response. Jesus had just then cured many people of diseases, plagues, evil spirits, and given sight to many who were blind. And he answered them, go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who does not take offense at me. Jesus' response goes all the way back to when he read from the prophet in Luke chapter 4, giving sight to the blind, setting the captives free, proclaiming the year of God's favor, and those who truly see him are no longer blind. They will be blessed. Not only blessed in their lives, but as they tell others, they will be blessed. Yeah. So Jesus really doesn't give them a straight answer, does he? They say, are you the one that is to come, or are we supposed to wait for somebody else? Jesus doesn't really give them a straight answer. Jesus says, it's up to you. What do you think? Once again, that question, who is this Jesus? What do you think? You've seen this stuff. You've heard this stuff. Go back and tell John what you've seen and what you've heard. The blind receive sight. The lame walk. Lepers are cleansed. The poor get this good news. Tell him what you've seen and heard, and tell him what you think. That's what it means when he said that, blessed is the one who takes no offense at me. When John's messengers had gone, and that, by the way, that message isn't just for them. That message is for me too. In fact, for all of us. We have to decide who is Jesus based on what we experience, what we hear, what we see, what we understand, and then notice what he said. He didn't say, think about it all, decide for yourself, and then you can go sit on the top of a mountain, look at the lint in your belly button and go home, or you know, decide something else. He said, when you decide, go and tell. When you decide, go and tell. When you think about what you've seen and heard, go and tell. Of course, Luke is recording some of these things as well to help the people in his day in the church in this predominantly Gentile culture to understand that there's more to Jesus and more to redemption and more to understanding Jesus than simply sitting back and thinking it through. Once you've come to the conclusion, it's a question that demands an answer. And once you come to the conclusion, then you are to work with that answer. That means go and tell. When John's messengers had gone, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. Basically, he says, why did you go out in the wilderness? A reed shaken by the wind? I mean, would that get you out there? No, I mean, you see that all the time. Why'd you go in the wilderness to see the wind blowing and a reed shake? No, you went out there to see John and to hear what was said and to try and figure out if the message was true. What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? No, you knew better than that with John. He didn't have the soft robes on. In fact, you want to stay upwind of him because he's in that camel's hair coat. Look, those who put on fine clothing and live in luxury are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes. That's why you went out there. Not for these other... You went to see and to hear a prophet. And I tell you, and more than a prophet, for this is the one about whom it is written, see, I am sending my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I tell you, among those born of women, no one is greater than John. Yet the least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. And all the people who heard this, including the tax collectors, acknowledged the justice of God because they had been baptized with John's baptism. But by refusing to be baptized by him, the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves. To what then will I compare the people of this generation, and what are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace, calling to one another, we played the flute for you and you didn't dance. We wailed and you didn't weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Nevertheless, wisdom is vindicated by all her children. Jesus' remarks here about John and about the tax collectors' praise of God is in stark contrast to the elders and the Pharisees, who are blind to God's presence. John saw the vision from God. The people who came to John were not the religious leadership. The people who came to John were the tax collectors, the other sinners, the people who were downcast, outcast, downtrodden. And they received that baptism because they listened to John's message and they believed that God was doing something good and something different to change their lives. So he says, the leaders will not understand God. The least, the poor, the oppressed, etc., will become greater in God's kingdom than even John or the Pharisees. And what he says here is, he says, John is the one that God said, John is Elijah, basically, here, is what he's saying. They believed Elijah would come back and announce the coming of the Messiah. He said, John is fulfilling that role. I send my messenger before you to prepare the way. And John came to prepare that way. But I'm going to tell you, there's nobody greater than him born of women. Why? Because He heard that call and he prepared the way so that the Messiah's message could be heard. We don't know for sure, but probably at least anywhere from, folks say anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4 years before. I mean, he was out there doing that up to 2-3 years before, out in the wilderness, coming in, etc., while Jesus was preparing himself. But others say, oh no, it was just 6 months because they're 6 months older, and Jesus turns 30. Well, John turned 30 6 months before Jesus. Yeah, there's this thing about 30. You know, that some people tend to think about. You know, Joseph Smith was about 30. Zarathustra, also known as Zoroaster, was about 30 when he went out into the desert, and Ahura Mazda appeared to him and, you know, gave him what became known as Zoroastrianism. You know, this thing about 30. Of course, we said earlier, Luke includes that story about Jesus in the temple at age 12, so that you wouldn't think all of a sudden he got 30 years old and got religion. But some people say because Jesus was 30 to 31 when he started, then John started about 6 months before him, because you've got the birth and then 6 months of John, then 6 months later Jesus. Well, their ministries would follow suit. That's total speculation. Some people say anywhere from 2 to 3 years, 4 years beforehand, out in the wilderness. Right. No, well, and the reason John's not there very much in the story is because who's the story really about? About Jesus, not John. So John could have been around a while, but Jesus, he prepared the way. Jesus comes on the scene, and the story, it's not Johnianity. It's Christianity based on Jesus the Christ. John plays his role up to a point, but then the important part of the story is God in Jesus as Christ. He says, you know, what am I going to compare you folks to? How about those kids that sit in the marketplace? The Pharisees and the elders are being childish. They're spoiled children. You don't like me. You don't play the way I want you to play. I'll just take my ball and go home. Nya, nya, nya. Somebody else has to go find the football. Yeah. Or the baseball. And what he's doing is he's really saying these folks who don't really necessarily know better, the tax collectors, the poor, the outcasts, the other sinners, you know, they haven't studied and had all of this opportunity for the knowledge and the ability to truly see. They're the ones who are open to seeing. Whereas the Pharisees and the religious elders, who should be the first ones to see and recognize, are blinded because it's their ball, or that's what they think. It's their ball, it's their horseshoes, their checkerboard. And somebody one time, I was at their house playing checkers, and I kept winning, and they got mad and just slammed the checkerboard closed and said, and went in the other room and put it in the closet and shut the door and said, you can't go in there. You know, in other words, you don't let me win, or if I don't win, then I'm going to take mine and go home. So what Jesus is saying, and he says, look, you folks, John came, he didn't eat bread, he didn't drink wine. You said he had a demon living, and he is living out in the desert. The Son of Man, that is Jesus, I come eating bread, drinking wine, being with the tax collectors and other sinners, and you say I'm a glutton and a drunkard, and people shouldn't pay attention to me either. John didn't do that, and he preached, and he baptized. You say, don't pay any attention to him. Now I come, and I associate with these folks, and I do this, and you say, oh, don't pay any attention to him. Why? Because it's our ball. But then he says, wisdom's children, though, those who are wise, will see God's work in both John and Jesus, and therefore they will become children of God. They will become children of God. And it is 6:44 and 40 seconds. We will pick up there next week, and I'll have another handout. I actually already have next week's runoff and all that kind of stuff. But we'll talk about it and start with questions next time about any of this or comments that you might have. The contrast continues between the religious leaders, the elders, the Pharisees. There is a Pharisee, and then there is a sinful woman. And we will pick up there. That's not you. Now, William thought his phone was ringing. Now.
First Baptist Church.
I'm not talking about how John was probably stinking.
That's probably all that sweat and the camel hair coat too. But we'll pick up there next time, and you know, next Sunday night, move forward looking at Jesus' power to forgive sins, and then who are really followers. That will be addressed in the rest of chapter 7 and over in chapter 8. And as you go, know this. No matter how small you might think you might be in the scheme of things, the least who are wise and who truly hear the words and follow Jesus are greater than those who pronounce, who rant and rave, and who say, send you $25 and we'll send you. And the least who understand and who are wise are greater than, Hans Kuhn said it in his book, The Church Maintained in Truth. And he said, oftentimes when popes pontificate and when cardinals and scholars and priests begin thinking that they have the only answers, it is the church and the wise within the church who have maintained the church in truth. So, be wise and follow the truth. God bless you. Go in peace. And I look forward to our next gathering together. Amen.